Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, and even though I'm basically in the content business here at Mixergy, right? I've created interviews here since, 2008. I'm not very high on content. I always feel like there's just so much of it online. How do you make a real business around it? It's just doesn't usually compute for me. I could see how you could help advance a mission. That's what I'm doing here at Mixergy, but real business, it feels like software is a better way to go. So even though I'm in it, I'm always shocked when I hear people talk about how they built a successful business that's a media company, especially from scratch, like today's guest did. Today's guest is Gerard Adams. In 2011, he helped create a company called Elite Daily. Elite Daily is kind of like the Huffington Post of Generation Y. He then sold it in 2015 to DMG Media. If you know the Daily Mail, that publication, then you know the company that bought him out. And they sold for a really impressive amount of money, considering how little they got in investment and how short a run they had with it. And I want to find out how he did it. I also want to find out about his current business. He is now running Founders. It helps millennials form and grow businesses. Sometimes that means from scratch as entrepreneurs like you and I are doing. Sometimes it means by saying, hey, you know what? You probably shouldn't quit your job and maybe you can be an intrapreneur, which is an entrepreneur inside a company or a freelancer. And always it means helping millennials find what success really means to them and acting on it. All right. We're going to find out how he built both of those businesses and so much more thanks to two great sponsors. The first will help you hire your next great developer. It's called TopTal. And the second is the tool that we use to get our guests on interviews like Gerard Adams here today. It's called Acuity Scheduling. First, Gerard, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate the intro.
The day that you sold, you said that you went in the back boardroom with your co-founders and did what?
Well, we went into that back boardroom and we basically looked at each other in the eyes and said, are we really doing this? Did this really happen? And then, you know, I really had to make that decision. If it was the right move or not, we looked at each other in the eyes and, you know, we said, you know, we started this together. Are we going to finish it together? Is it the right move to make? We have two options on the table. We had raised $5 million in a short period of time as another option. And we basically looked at each other and said, let's go back into that boardroom and this is the right move to make. This gives us security for the company, you know, and it's a win for us, our investors, and it's a dream come true. It may not be that $1 billion number. But it's more about the fact that like we did it. We built a company that really created enough value that, you know, the likes of a $1 billion company like the Daily Mail wanted to take it over. And so we went back in there and when we made that vote, man, it was like, I can't even tell you. The emotions that went through my body. I mean, it was crazy.
What'd you sell for?
Close to 50 million.
Close to 50 million. Yeah. Cash?
Yeah, cash.
Wowee. Wow. So I've heard 40 to 50 million from Business Insider. How close to 50?
Yeah. Pretty close with all the incentives baked in, and in the high 40s.
Wow. And I'm guessing you became a millionaire based on that deal, right? Or were you one before? I can't tell. I told you before we started that you had a backstory that as much as I researched, I didn't fully get to the bottom of.
So I had actually become a millionaire when I was 24 years old. And then interesting, that was right before the recession hit. So right around 2000, going into 2010, I had lost all the millions that I had saved up.
Wait, how did you become a millionaire at 23?
24? 24. So basically, when I started my career, I started with the interest in the stock market, and I had an early on failure that kind of led me to the success. Basically, my first project was building an online forum called StockSpot, where people were able to come on, talk about stocks that they liked, and each member had a rating 1 to 5 that I pretty much stole from like an eBay. Mm-hmm. And I built it just so that I can learn from other people who wanted to trade stocks, so that I can learn from them. And, you know, from just like really spamming every message board that I can go on to, hey, come to StockSpot and talk on my platform, you know, little by little, I was able to build about 10,000 active users, which was a lot back then. And that led me to a CEO reaching out to me when I was like 19 saying, I don't think you understand the value of what you've created. I would love to advertise on here, but you know what? Let me meet you, because he was also from New Jersey. I met him. He became a mentor of mine, and we built a relationship, and he ended up mentoring me to become the director of investor relations for his nanotechnology company. During that year, I had done everything I learned through digital marketing I had done for his company. And, you know, I was fascinated by the fact that he was reinventing the battery with nanotechnology. Mm-hmm. And then basically I said to Ron, the CEO, hey, let's do our first ever demo day. During that, he was like, you handle everything. So I literally got my buddy, who was a wedding DJ, to set up a stage and speakers and a mic like this. And basically I invited the media, investment bankers. And that day, was the day that I actually, it was the first time I ever did a public speech, introduced the CEO, and a classic demo day failure. They went to prove out this battery, hit this button, prove out that once they hit this button, that's when energy would be used to prove out that it was an infinite shelf life battery, and that just crickets. It just didn't work. Mm-hmm. I thought my career was over. I was devastated. But a couple guys came up to me and said, hey kid, I'm surprised you got me in the room. Here's my card, call me. And at that point I said to myself, man, like, you know, I did get 200 people in this room. I did get this company on the cover of Wired magazine. I built like an amazing viral video for the company. We built their website. I wrote their press release. I did so much marketing. So I was like, there's got to be other companies out there that will be more prepared, and I can help shine light on and telling their story. So I ended up creating an agency to do just that. I literally printed out every single small cap company that I can find, CEO's name, number, fax, phone number, email. And I would literally call, email, fax, send them direct mail, say, give me a shot. I finally got my first client for $750. I would, and I would just overperform for them, get them written up. I would network with all these different bloggers and learn. I started mastering pay-per-click back then, how to help build out their email list. And little by little, I took from making $750 per client to, over those next 4 years, becoming, you know, one of the most sought after digital marketers for small cap companies, having clients pay me six figures. And
to help promote their stock, not their products, right?
Correct. To promote their stock and their company. Correct.
And this is at the same time that you ran Stock Spot.
Yeah. So that was when I had Stock Spot, and then I took that into a company called Wall Street Grand.
Wait, so even though you're moderating this community of people who are all trying to figure out what stocks to invest in, you're also helping to promote small cap stocks, which is kind of a dangerous spot to be in, right?
Well, no, I didn't use Stock Spot for that. So then I sold Stock Spot and then moved into that company, Wall Street Grand, that I just mentioned.
What year did you sell Stock Spot?
Oh man, I was back in probably 2000 and I want to say 7, 8, right around then.
Okay. And then the revenue from there was coming all from advertising?
I didn't hardly had any like real revenue from there. Okay. The real revenue kicked in once I learned that these companies needed help with digital marketing. And then that's when I went and built the agency and didn't use that platform.
What's the name of the agency?
Wall Street Grand.
Wall Street Grand. And then at what point did you lose all the money that you were telling us about before?
2011, I think it was right there, yeah.
So just before you started Elite.
Correct.
Okay. How much did you lose, and what did you do that you lost it all?
So I ended up losing $20 million. I was up $20 million. So I basically started taking – so what ended up happening was, with this agency, I started not liking the industry. I started getting contacted by a ton of companies that wanted me to help them promote their stock. And I was like, well, this is what you mentioned almost. This is a dangerous spot to be in. I'm really great at what I do, but – what I learned is like a ton of these companies fail, like 90% of them, if not more, probably 99% of them end up like mismanaging money and like not getting their products to market. And I just didn't like, I didn't enjoy it. I just started saying to myself, like, this is not where I want to be. So I started actually going and visiting companies that I did think were investable, that were more, I was a fundamentalist. So I would find companies that had strong balance sheets, strong revenue growth, cash, no debt. And I would go and visit them. I would invest in them into the open market. And I would shoot a video. I would interview the CEO. I would then talk about them, similar to like Warren Buffett. And I would fully disclose that I'm invested into this company. But I would put a hold in my disclaimer that I wouldn't sell for 6 months while talking about why I invested into this company. And I did really well. I invested into a lot of gold companies, a lot of miners. During the recession, I was doing really, really well. And then I was up $20 million into the market. I had invested into a TV everywhere company, had the patents for streaming content through mobile devices. And I just got overly, just overly cocky, thinking I was, you know, this young mid-20s, thought I was invincible. And one day, just the market just tanked. And everything.
When you
that
say
I
you lost $20 million, did you lose? You actually had $20 million in cash in the bank, and then you put it into this business, and you lost it?
No, I had $20 million in gains in my brokerage account. There was $20 million worth of equity.
I see.
And I basically could
in
have
small cap stocks, which means that even
mid cap, yeah,
okay. Because small cap stocks are tremendously volatile. Just moving your money out would have reduced their value, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. I can't really find enough research on that, but it's because it's not the kind of thing that would be public unless you showed more of your. Would you be willing to show the brokerage statements from that period of your life?
I would have to probably, I can probably call up, yeah, I could probably call
really?
Up those brokers and probably find that out. Yeah.
All right. So then I see where you were. I'm wondering then, how did you end up with money to invest in this new online publication?
So I had to sell a lot of things. At that time, I had a couple Bentleys. I had a pen, you know, I had things that I had bought. I bought some real estate. So I ended up having to start selling a lot of my cars, selling a lot of my assets. And, you know, I lost the majority of my net worth, but I still had a little bit of money. Just wasn't a millionaire anymore. You know, at that time, you know, I probably had a couple $100,000, you know, that, and then I was able to sell some of those assets. And then, you know, I basically heard a story from my mother who told me how she grew up basically losing everything. My grandparents, living with my grandparents in a family of five, the apartment caught on fire. I talked about it in my TEDx talk. And I didn't know this until this time when I had this happen to me. And she said, we lost everything. And I had to basically drop out of school at like 15 years old to go get it, to go on Canal Street in New York to make a little bit of money to help provide for your grandparents. And if I was able to do that and put this roof over your heads, you better believe you better go back out there and do it again. And then that's kind of like, that really like hit me hard. And saying, you know what, it is what it is. You know, I lost this money. I learned a lot about my ego and saying, you know, this can happen. Money can come, can be taken right away from you. And, but I can't, you know, one thing that I still had was my knowledge for like my passion for content, my passion for creating, and digital marketing expertise. And that's when I was like, okay, what's next? What can I do?
You talked to our producer before this interview and you said, look, I was looking at millennials, this new group of people who are just starting to emerge as potential audiences and customers for businesses. And you saw what when you looked at millennials? What did you notice that helped you come up with the idea for Elite Daily?
Well, it was interesting. Right before Elite Daily, how it started happening is that when I lost all this money, I started making documentaries. You can find them on YouTube. The last one was called College Conspiracy. And I had created this documentary. I was one of the first to expose the student loan debt crisis. And the reason being is right around that time, around that 2010, going into 2011 time, that's when after that recession happened, I had lost all my money. My father had gotten laid off and all my friends are graduating from college. I'm one of those older millennials that like right around that time was when like every one of my friends were literally going through the moment of graduating college, having this degree, having all of this debt and couldn't get a job. And yet they're all paying attention to reality TV, the Jersey Shore, Kim Kardashians. So I was like, okay, I just lost all this money. All my friends are coming to me for a job, yet they're the ones who had the degree, and I look like the failure all these years. My father got laid off. This country has the largest national debt crisis in history. This is crazy. And I actually knew, you know, I actually was understanding of the markets because of what just happened. So I was really fascinated by the economy. So I started making documentaries on the economy and to educate millennials on like our national debt crisis and how like you don't need to go to college. And that was when it kind of started to spark this interest of like, you know, of content for millennials. And then my intern who was working for me, David, who then I was, you know, told him like, you need to become the CEO of this company. This idea came to me. He's like, I want to create a publication. And at first, he was like, I want to create elite Wall Street. And I was like, whoa. I just went through years of complete, like, absolute torment of, like, ups and downs and almost, like, ruining my career. Like, Wall Street's tainted. No way. And he wanted to educate millennials around finance and business. I said, we could do something much bigger. And let's look at all the landscape of media, all these publications that are handed down to us, and look at how there's all these different verticals of the news that we're looking for in the market. Let's create something bigger. And then that's when we all sat in an apartment together and said elite. And then I hit the word daily. We were able to buy it for $9.99. And that's like when it all kind of got started.
You said David was his name. He was the co-founder.
Yeah, correct.
David. And then that's David Arabov. Am I pronouncing his last name right?
Yes.
And then was the other co-founder, David Arabov, was he the son of Jacob the Jeweler, the guy who's in all the hip hop videos?
Yes, Jacob. So at that time when I started mentoring David, actually Jacob was away, and David came to me for mentorship because he didn't have, at that point in time in his life, he didn't really have someone that was help guiding him.
Jacob was away where?
He was incarcerated at that time.
Incarcerated for what?
To be honest, I don't know the whole complete story. I think it was basically for something with taxes, Okay.
All right. Yeah. And so his son, and this is the guy, am I right that he's the guy in all the hip hop guys are talking about?
Correct.
Right. And so here, apparently June 2006, according to Wikipedia, he was arrested on charges of money laundering and conspiracy in connection with Detroit-based Black Mafia family, as well as for not declaring large cash purchases to the IRS, which I imagine every jeweler is probably doing, but maybe I'm cynical that way. So how did his son end up being your intern?
That story is pretty funny. I mean, basically I had a trainer working mm-hmm. with me. One day my trainer comes to the gym and he's wearing this iced out G-Shock, and I'm like, dude, that is badass. Mm-hmm. Like, where do I get an iced out G-Shock? Back then I thought that was so cool. And he was like, well, come with me. I'm going to introduce you. And his other client was Jacob's wife, Angela, who's one of the most amazing women I've ever met in my entire life. And she brought me to their store in Manhattan. And when I got there, I mean, this store is like unbelievable. Like, Pharrell's on the wall, all these amazing people on the wall. It was just a really cool experience. I met Jay-Z there. And here I go in the back, and there's this young kid, David. He's probably like 18, uh-huh. 18 at the time. And here he is like hustling me G-Shock watches. I'm like, you're fucking amazing. And he asked to go out and hang out. We went out and hung out. And then I got to know his mother. And his mother basically said, David doesn't have right now someone to really guide him. And he's going out, he's partying, and he comes from a wealthy family. So, he had the Maybach, and they had that lifestyle, and he saw that lifestyle. And his mother and David, when I got to spend some time with David, we met up at the Gansevoort Hotel, sat down together, and he opened up to me and said, the only real mentor I've had in my life was like, other than my parents and my father's way right now, is my basketball coach. I don't have anyone to guide me. And I want to make a name for myself. I don't want to be in the jewelry business. I don't want to follow my father's footsteps. I want to make a name for myself, and I don't know where to go. So I said, well, show up at my office tomorrow, and we'll take it from there. And he started coming to my office every day since then, interning. Wow. And then that's kind of, we built this relationship where he was like my little brother.
Wow. And then the third co-founder was Jonathan Francis?
Yeah, JSP.
JSP. Wait, yeah. How'd you end up with JSP from Jonathan Francis?
His name also was Jonathan San Pedro. I think it's like Jonathan Francis San Pedro.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. So we all knew him as JSP.
How'd you guys connect with him?
Well, actually, JSP worked for Jacob growing up, and JSP went to Pace University as well as David. He was a little older than David, so they had also known each other from college as well, and they were good friends. So when David was coming to me with this idea and we're working on it, we needed someone who was a little bit more tech savvy, and JSP actually had a little bit more of the, he understood, I guess you can say back then it was as basic as WordPress. Uh-huh. And, that's how it was. It was just like, he brought JSP, brought him to the office. We started all kicking it, and it was it. We just decided let's do this thing. And I took a real liking to JSP. I mean, he's probably the hardest working, young man I've ever worked with my entire life.
All right. I'm going to take a moment here to tell everyone about a piece of software that I love. But when we come back, I'm going to talk about how you figured out what the subject of the – or what the content was going to be on the site. And then how you guys mastered Facebook. You guys were huge on Facebook before most people even understood it. Even Kara Swisher from Recode said she basically had to sell to Vox because they couldn't figure out social. But Vox did, and it was so hard. You guys figured it out. I want to ask you about that. I want to ask you about why you guys sold. But first, I've got to tell you about this tool. And you know what? Let me take it back a step and tell you about this guy, Nathan Berry. He had a company that was doing well, $5,000 a month in revenue, and then it started to struggle, $2,000 a month in revenue. And he said, something's not working out here. I've got to get serious. And I said, what did you do to get serious? And he said, you know, I decided I was going to make sales myself to each new customer. And he had this software that allowed people to send out email. So he found people who needed to send out email in bulk, and he started to schedule phone calls with them. And the more he talked to them, the more he realized some of the shortcomings of his software and also some of the high points that got people to say, yes, I will buy and sign up for your software. And by making those calls, he was actually able to grow sales and also figure out the product and turn things around. I just talked to him the other day. His site is called ConvertKit. Let me look at the up-to-date numbers on ConvertKit. Bear. This is where I should have my data up ahead of time. Here, I want to tell you guys where his monthly revenue is as of today. $630,000 in monthly recurring revenue. And the thing that turned it around was actually talking to his customers. A lot of times we talk about on-page SEO, off-page SEO, social, etc. But ultimately, talking to your customers will help you really understand what they want and what you need to create for them. The problem with talking to your customers is hard to get them on the phone. That's why I recommend you check out Acuity Scheduling. With Acuity Scheduling, you have one link. You could send it out to any potential customer or existing customer and say, pick any date for my calendar and schedule a call with me. You make it really easy, and then people are much more likely to get on a call with you. So if you want people to get on the call with you, if you want people to get on the call with your team, use the tool that I here at Mixergy have used now for, I'd say, over 5 years, maybe even coming up on the whole run here at Mixergy. Acuity Scheduling makes it super easy. You tell it when you're available. You tell it what information you want to collect from people. And then they give you a link that you can send out. Go check out acuityscheduling.com/Mixergy. When you add that slash Mixergy to the URL, they're going to give you a whole bunch of free time, 45 days for free. Go check them out at acuityscheduling.com/Mixergy. They're even going to schedule you a private one-on-one consulting session if you really want to know how to do it right. Go check out the details at acuityscheduling.com/Mixergy. Gerard, I noticed that you, before the interview started, I said, how do I describe this in one sentence? And you said, it's like the Huffington Post from millennials. You guys studied the Huffington Post when you were trying to figure out how to write, how to speak to your audience, right? And what content to create. Didn't you?
To be honest, I mean, we were very naive in the very beginning. We did study the Huffington Post. We studied Complex. But to be honest, a lot of it in the beginning was like interviewing each other, interviewing our friends. It was a lot of a lot of naivety, like actually testing different things out, different verticals out.
What's a vertical that you were testing out in the beginning that in retrospect was just off?
Believe it or not, business, like entrepreneurship. Like in the very beginning, like we actually wanted it a lot to be around like entrepreneurs and business. And we were it ended up being that that wasn't the most, that wasn't getting highlighted. That wasn't, a lot of people weren't engaging the most with that content. They cared more about culture pop and entertainment and dating. Dating happened to be the number one, vertical. But for some
dating
reason,
was the number one vertical.
Yes.
You know what? I'm looking at the dating site, the dating category right now. Here are some of the headlines. Men admit their excuses to get girls out of their bed when they're done hooking up. A nice guy and a fuckboy reveal how to go from being his option to his top choice. The 5 best first date conversation starters to help you actually get to know someone. That's the stuff. How did you even get anyone to pay attention to these articles that you guys were producing to see whether they were successful or not?
It really was Facebook. Facebook was our number one driving.
From the beginning?
Yeah. I mean, very, very much in the beginning, like we knew that we needed to attack Facebook very quickly. I think we were lucky enough to catch that wave early on, whereas like Facebook algorithms have changed over the years. I mean, I think when we sold, it was at the height mm-hmm. when they had made that shift and our traffic had significantly taken a hit, and we kind of saw that coming. But in the beginning, it was like, that's where we knew where our friends were, you know? I mean, especially David. I mean, he was very much, you know, very focused on Facebook. I mean, and focusing on all the different, you know, popular people that were at different college universities. And he would literally, in the beginning, I remember, like, hit up every single friend of his that was at Pace University, be like, you have to share our articles, you know?
And it was, I see. And then as you developed, it was finding the people who had the most followers and saying, share this article?
Yeah, it was definitely a lot of getting people who had the most friends to share our articles, engage with our articles.
I see. And then how systematic were you about it? Did David have a spreadsheet with the names of the top people? Was it a CRM? Was it just trying to feel it out?
I mean, in the very beginning, it wasn't organized. I mean, it was literally, I think we had, I started off with having like an Excel, but it was literally just, it was more like quantity over quality in the very beginning. It was, let's hit up as many friends and people we know and their friends of friends, and let's get it out as much as we possibly can, uh-huh. as possible on a 24-hour basis. And then over time, we got more methodical with it, and we actually started looking at like who were actually more influencers, and also how we can form more distribution partners and strategic partnerships with like the Huffington Post, with Complex, with other publications, and sharing and each other's content. And I think that, you know, that also helped significantly.
What did that look like when you were sharing each other's content? What was that process? I mean, was it that the Huffington Post on their social media accounts would post your articles and you do the same for them?
Yes, but it was also some original content. Like, we actually were able to structure deals where we would write some original content for them, and we would also do different series for them. So like similar to doing our podcast, we would actually be guests on Huffington Post Live a lot of times and going on their live. Sharing content that way as well.
And then what was in it for them? I get that you get a lot of promotion. What did they get out of it?
I mean, to be honest, it was just that cross collaboration of them getting more exposure to our audience and vice versa.
I see.
And you know, we anyone who worked for us, nobody was older than like 22 years old. Mm-hmm. It was very young, and we had that millennial culture. And, you know, a lot of the people that we started inviting to the office and inviting, we did a lot of like parties at the office and invited the media and the industry to come by. And, you know, we did that with the industry to build relationships mm-hmm. and to get them to get to know each other. We also did that with our influencers and with getting people to want to contribute for us, and contributing writing staff was like, you know, we had over 2,000 contributors. That was another like huge factor.
Kind of like the Huffington Post did too, where Arianna Huffington in the early days would just tell everyone she met that they should be blogging on the Huffington Post. I think it was the New Yorker article about her that said that she would go see a doctor and tell the doctor that he's got a blog on Huffington Post and give him an account. Was it that kind of a thing, that you would give out a lot of accounts so that you have more content? Every time someone publishes content, they have an incentive to promote it?
In the beginning, it was. And then we actually had a department to curate our contributors to see. And then we created like a leaderboard. So depending on how, you know, how many shares and how viral your articles would get, we would showcase the editors out there, the contributors out there that were at the top of that leaderboard.
I see.
And create a little bit of a gamification with it.
I see. You also told our producer listicles were very big, which actually they were for a long time, for BuzzFeed, for Huffington Post and others. Do you remember how you discovered, was it just looking at the traffic and realizing anything with a number does well, or was it something else?
We caught that wave of the listicles, and I mean, it was a lot of testing and then studying. And then, I mean, it really was, we ended up bringing a data scientist in. I wish we did in the early days, you know, going after like, I think our going into like our third year, we ended up having like a lot of, you know, a lot of data, studying that data, understanding that odd numbers work better than even numbers. Mm-hmm. Really, we would even study like the different words and like study which articles were going more viral than others and what words and the different title tags and the different tags. And we would send all that out to our contributors so that they knew and they had a better opportunity to be able to get more viral articles.
Speaking of words, when I said the word fuck in the headline, I was just reading it because it happened to be there. And then I looked up at you as I said it, and it seemed like you were uncomfortable with that. But that seems like a word that has historically done well for you and still to this day does well, right? Fuck with the U, and I usually don't curse here, but I also don't want to be a baby about it, with the U turned into an asterisk, right?
Yeah, I agree. You know, I actually – I think when I saw Tony Robbins, when I first went to his first UPW and I saw how many fucks he says right on stage, that's when I was like, okay, all right, it's not that bad.
It's okay, actually. It has actually become an okay word. Not just Tony Robbins, but the Wall Street Journal recently had an article about how books with curses in the title do better recently. Have been doing not better, but have been doing well recently and are making it to the top charts. Right?
Wow. Yeah.
Like the subtle art of not giving a fuck. And then there's asterisk, right?
Yeah.
I keep seeing that book everywhere.
You know, it's interesting to me though, because like when I felt that way, I think it was less about the fuck and was more of like, man, like when it is your company, you care about every article. When it's not your company anymore, I don't even know what's being written. You know what I mean?
So I'm right. And now it kind of represents you in this interview, but you didn't write it.
Yeah. So it was
that's where that discomfort came from. Yeah. What about when you allow so many people to write on your site, but it's your site and you care about everything? How do you come to terms with that?
You know, I think that's kind of what made us successful. It was like, you know, we claimed to be the voice of Generation Y, and you know, we wanted to allow everyone to have that voice, to be able to have that opinion and share it. And we pissed a lot of people off. There was no doubt about it. I mean, we had even nasty articles written about us. We allowed people to have those the rebuttals though, and you know. We had a really Caitlin, who's still with Elite Daily today. She was our editor in chief, and she was like, you know, I think she was so badass. I mean, she really, I think, managed it well, and by just you know, really allowing people to share the way they felt about certain things. And
it was sexism that you guys got a lot of flack for. Sexism and identity theft, or not identity theft, or pseudonym publishing. Sexism, where you'd have posts like 21 signs she's expired. I'm reading this right out of Wikipedia, but I saw it in other places. Right, 21 signs she's expired. Number 15 was three fingers fit. Ooh, I see what that means. Actually, I probably wouldn't have read that if I saw it ahead of time. Yeah, I get that. So what do you think of that? That some of the posts would get you more traffic, but they were sexist or misogynistic.
Yeah, I would agree. I take ownership for it. I think that looking back, I think we definitely got caught in the game of clicks, you know, and there's no doubt about it. I take ownership for that.
Isn't that okay? Because I kind of look back on the early days of Mixergy and I'd say whatever I wanted just to get attention. I would experiment a lot more. And I think that made Mixergy more interesting. Now being cautious because I have more to protect makes it a little... I don't know. It feels cautious, less exciting, less. I discover pockets of growth. I don't discover pockets of growth as often because of that. I don't discover pockets of ideas because I'm not pushing against accepted ideas as much. What do you think? It's okay to push boundaries. It's okay even to piss people off. And frankly, this is me saying it, not you, because I'm not sexist. I think I should be a little at times, right? Not because I want to be, not because that's who I am, but I think I got to throw that caution out the window. What do you think of that?
I love that. I mean, I definitely agree, you know. I agree when you push those boundaries and you're just like, you're free and just speak what's on your mind, speak how you feel. And, you know, sometimes you could be a little bit of a – or it could be an asshole, or people will disagree with you, but it makes you who you are. And I think the realer you are, I think today more than ever before, people respect you for that.
Yeah. You know what? One of the sites that's kind of following in your footsteps is The Hustle. Do you know them at all?
Yeah, I've seen them.
They did a post once about Tim Ferriss's height. It's like this whole big thing about how tall or short is Tim Ferriss. And I thought, ooh, this is kind of a weirdo, not a weirdo thing. This is kind of a like an insult based on a person's characteristic, who they were born as opposed to what they did. And I told the founder, and he kind of laughed it off. And sure enough, Tim Ferriss now is one of the investors. So I just don't think people are as upset as we think they are. And then when he got Tim Ferriss as an investor, he gave him a headlock because apparently he told a friend once that one day I will get Tim Ferriss to invest in my company and I will give him a headlock. You watch. So he got both.
That's awesome.
Right. Listicles did well for you guys. I wonder how you came up with the voice of the site and how you communicated that to your writers. What was the process for that?
Well, we had a strong editorial team that basically, again, managed all of these contributors, communicated to them daily, really sent them all of the different articles that had been that we saw that were very popular in the news and what was going viral. We leveraged Twitter, we leveraged Twitter and Pinterest and Reddit, and just really was constantly analyzing the market and what people were talking about most. And through our editorial team, we had a whole staff that managed the process. And then David particularly was the one who looked at every single article
before it went out.
Correct.
And he was then the content guy and also the promotions guy.
So he was the one who decided every single article. So I take that back. I apologize. He looked at every single article prior to going on Facebook, which was really like our number one source.
I see.
Of traffic.
Prior, when you say on Facebook, you mean your Facebook page or prior to starting with this promotion machine of yours?
Our Facebook page.
I see. Okay. All right. And then you guys got Andy Reese on to help you with revenue.
Correct.
How did you find him and how did he help you with revenue?
So we had never built a publication like this. You had mentioned it in the beginning, where you said, how do you make money with content? I never understood it. I mean, we were in the same boat. Like, we just wanted to create this. We knew that we felt that there was a need for it. We were opening up so many different tabs for so many different publications to get news that we were entertained by and excited about. So we just created this, but we didn't really understand how we were going to make money from it. And then in the beginning, we're like, well, let's just focus on building a community. Let's just focus on building our audience, building our traffic, getting people that want to read Elite Daily. And then once we started seeing that it was working and we had this traffic, we were kind of like, okay, now what? Like, how are we going to really monetize this thing? Luckily through a mutual relationship, a gentleman named Oliver, he knew Andy Reese. And one day we just got a meeting with this company called Black Ocean that Andy Reese was a part of. Mm-hmm. We went in to meet with them. And, Andy just happened, to offer to basically give us that expertise, to be a mentor to us, to understand what it meant to actually, turn this traffic into dollars. And, to help us build our tech stack and what that meant. And
what is it? What does it mean? What's a tech stack?
Yeah. I mean, basically the everything behind the site, the whole back end, that's going to allow you to run advertisements on your site, know where you're going to place those ads and then how, those are going to actually convert to impressions into paid advertising dollars, to your platform. And, the server that's going to be behind it to host all of these ads. That was something that we didn't have any expertise in.
Here's what Black Ocean's description is in the Google search result. Black Ocean is a technology company that builds next generation digital businesses. We look to solve real world problems through technology. So it sounds like it's a dev shop.
They were more of like an incubator at the time when we were there. I mean, they would house us, they were housing other startups, but they had a couple of different in-house, people that were developers.
I see. So they coded up your ad delivery process and helped you think it through. Is that right?
Yes.
I see. Okay. And then do they get paid to build it or do they get paid a commission of the ads?
They got paid a commission on the ads, and then they became an investor.
I see. How much money did you guys take on? I think the original money was put by you, according to the TechCrunch article that I saw when you guys launched. You put in $30,000. $50,000, right?
Correct.
And then how much money did you guys take on after that?
And then we did a $1.5 million convertible note that we extended to about $2 million before the exit.
And that was it. The $5 million that you were offered before was actually not – you didn't take that $5 million. It was just something that you were offered just before the sale. What about Black Ocean? They put money in too?
They put in some money as well. Not a lot. A little around $100,000.
I see.
But primarily the money came in from VCs.
What was the site built on? I was trying to figure out whether you guys built your own platform or use WordPress or something else.
We built it. Yeah, we built it on WordPress, believe it or not. Yep.
But it seems like a really edited version of WordPress, right?
Very much.
I don't even see the standard WordPress URL structure in here.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to look back at version one, you would definitely notice it. Once it got to like version 3, version 4, it was very, very customized.
I see. What kind of customizations did you do? Do you remember?
I would have to lean on our CTO at that point, Adrian Goris, who was in charge of all of that.
Okay.
But I mean, I think the biggest customization to it was the fact of now we were able to allow profiles for our contributors, and be able to allow them to actually now basically kind of own their own channel within Elite Daily, where they had all of their articles. People can now follow the contributor and get alerted on when they were contributing certain articles.
I see. All right. Let me take a moment to talk about my second sponsor. Do you know TopTal?
I do not.
Cool. I'll tell you then. TopTal is a network of some of the best developers out there. And in the past, when I talk about TopTal, I've told people that if they need to hire a developer, they can just contact TopTal, tell TopTal what they're looking for, and then TopTal will find the perfect developer. Often that person or team of developers even can start within a day or two. And I've given them examples of guys like Eric Brown, who created his software using TopTal developers. But you're bringing up a great point. Sometimes it's not a brand new thing from scratch that either needs to be built or needs to be improved because the team of developers that you've hired are already working on it, but they don't have time to, or you don't have enough resources to grow it. Sometimes it's just like what you guys did. You have a WordPress site and you say, I have all these requests, all these needs, but WordPress will not let me do it. And I'm not going to install every plugin because the plugins won't do it. And the things that they do could mess up everything else that we've got. Cause you know, there's conflicts opening with plugins. There's also other issues with viruses and malware with plugins lately. So what you do is you can do what I did and so many other WordPress sites have done. Go to TopTal, let them know that you're built on TopTal let them know you're built on WordPress and tell them what you want to do. And they will find a great WordPress developer to build it out for you. So many people who have listened to Mixergy interviews have used TopTal. I've got to keep recommending them because I look good when you guys sign up to TopTal. I look good to you. You sign up, you get great results, and then you'll thank me the way that Eric and so many others have. So here's a special URL for Mixergy listeners. If you need a great developer for WordPress or anything else, start something from scratch, grow your team, whatever it is, go check out toptal.com/Mixergy. You as a Mixergy listener are going to get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. Think about that, 80 hours of TopTal developer credit. That's fantastic that they're giving that out. Only to Mixergy people, go check out toptal.com/Mixergy. Top is in top of the mountain. Tal is in talent.com/Mixergy. How involved were you day to day? It seemed from that first article that I read about you guys that you were going to be the money guy and the guidance guy, but you weren't going to run the business. Is that what happened?
Very much. Definitely. Like my job was, you know, mentoring David, mentoring JSP, helping them build culture, helping them build a team, helping them with the vision. And then basically, once we were actually building the company on a day-to-day basis, I wasn't the one who was managing like the content or the tech or anything else. I was out there helping, you know, and get introductions for investors, for strategic partners, for advertisers, you know, things in that nature, helping us build our advisory board, and just continuing to help David and supporting the founders. So like every week working with them, making sure that they were like really focusing on growth, whether day to day, like, hey, what is our vision over this next year? How are we hitting our KPIs? How are we on a month to month maintaining our growth and setting ourselves up for the, you know, for potentially an acquisition one day or to become the biggest millennial publication in the world. You know, that was
the
goal.
What'd you do to set yourself up for possible sale?
Well, one, after it was finally like cleaning up our mess, like cleaning up our, you know, we had to like restructure our docs from a legal standpoint. We had to get like our accounting in order, like really like get our foundation really put together. And then it was just, you know, to be honest, it was like we saw BuzzFeed as like our biggest peer. We saw John Steinberg leave BuzzFeed. We knew that he was going to the Daily Mail and we were just like, what an opportunity right now. Like, this is perfect. And they're a UK company. They want to get a footprint in the US. I tracked John down at a Morgan Stanley event that he spoke at, waited for him by the door, elevator pitched him, gave him my card, got him interested in Elite Daily. Then we worked one of our investors that was part of that round that knew John and hit him from that end as well, saying, hey, we need to get John on as an advisor. What can we do to incentivize him? And then basically got John to the office, got him on our advisory board. And once he kind of saw the culture and, saw that it was real, really studied our analytics, started getting close with David, working with David. And the next thing you know, it was like, we envisioned this, but we never thought it would really truly happen especially in like a, you know, in a very short window. It was within 6 months that he made the offer. And
within 6 months of him, of you meeting him or of him signing on to be an advisor?
Within 6 months, pretty much of me meeting him.
Wow.
He became an advisor at a very, very shortly after I met him. Luckily, one of our investors was buddies with him and knew him. Yeah, so that was it really worked out.
He was the president and COO of BuzzFeed, as you said. He went on to Mail Online, and now he's the founder of Cheddar, which is like what you guys did, but only for finance, right? Finance for millennials,
right?
When you guys talk to an advisor, what do you do to actually use that relationship properly? I find that a lot of people ask for advisors, they'll get an advisor, and then they won't use that person. Maybe from time to time they'll ask for an introduction, but that's it. What did you do to actually work well with your advisors?
I mean, we really it's communication. You know, I think for us it was like we really, really communicated really well consistently about what was going on in the company. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs, founders, like, I don't know how, if they get so caught up in the day to day that maybe they don't think to, maybe they, every once in a while, send out a request for a contact or whatnot. For us, it was like, we bombarded our advisors. We were like constantly calling them, asking them questions, sending them, summaries of like what we were doing, how we were doing it, you know, where can they really help us? And it was also very, it was strategy and like thinking about, for us, how can we get the right advisors on board that relate to our industry so that they would end up wanting to become investors into our company or be able to bring us the right partnerships or potential acquirers. And therefore, like, that was our real goal. I think you want to leverage your advisors to obviously get that mentorship and learn from their experience. Like, for instance, Andy Reese was like a great also advisor to us and really helped bring real value to us to learn how to monetize. But then you also want to leverage your advisory board to set you up for growth. And that can mean like a big strategic partner because they have that big relationship, or maybe they're in a similar, similar sector where they can become that acquirer for you, and you want to build that relationship with them and show them that like you're all in and that you're continuing to grow that company so that they take an interest.
How formal was the advisor relationship with you? Was there a signed agreement? Was there what was it?
With John?
With any one of them. Yeah, let's talk about John specifically.
Very,
how formal?
Yeah, very, very formal. I mean, we definitely made sure to get a formal advisory agreement. Typical advisor agreement for us was about 0.25 to 0.5%. If it was somebody like extremely, you know, we did one advisory deal that, you know, we kind of regretted and bought back his shares with Jonathan Chaban, who was Kim Kardashian's best friend. I believe he was a little bit more than a percent. We ended up buying back those shares. But, you know, we would leverage our advisory shares to
get. And you'd be specific with them about what you need them to do.
Yeah. You know, with Jonathan, it was like, hey, we really want to be able to get Kim Kardashian to share our content. We really want to be able to get in front of different celebrities that want to be ambassadors for Elite Daily and just sharing our content. You know, we ended up getting a lot of his friends to share that content.
All right. Finally, the sale. Why did you guys decide to sell instead of raise more money and keep on growing?
So we wanted to let me reframe that. I wanted to not sell. I didn't want to sell. I wanted to hold on to what we had. And that's mainly because John Steinberg was valuing us based upon revenue. And, you know, I felt we were just scratching the surface. This was like our third year. And we were focusing so much on just building our traffic, continuing our growth. We had revenue coming in, but like we really didn't hit our trajectory yet. And I just felt like if we went one more year, we would have broken, you know, we would have been more profitable. So I didn't want to sell. And I was basically also looking at the comps in the industry. I mean, BuzzFeed at the time, I believe, was valued at like $800 million. You know, all of these other really big publications were valued at hundreds of millions, if not in the billions. So I just felt like we were undercutting ourselves. Initially went to go do a raise in Silicon Valley and, you know, we met with a lot of, you know, SFVCs, but they started calling our lead Graycroft and we just felt like they were beating us down. And the reason was, is they knew that we only had like a 3-month runway. So they were trying to, invest at a really super low valuation. So we were like stuck in a really tough position. And that's when I like went really hard, before the last board meeting to make a decision. And I went to some of my initial mentors in life that are successful, and they decided that they wanted to back us, and they decided they would come in for $5 million and we had a $1 million kill switch. So we had that come through last minute, like right in that board meeting. But Alan Patrickoff himself was in that meeting and all of our investors, and you know, I gave a speech on why I believed that, you know, we should maybe not take this. We shouldn't take this acquisition. But then I took my two partners outside of that conference room, sat down with David and JSP, like I mentioned earlier. And, you know, I said, guys, I did everything I could to just give us another option on the table. But, you know, David, you're day in and day out, you know this business better than anybody else. So what do you think? And same thing with JSP. And they said, look, Gerard, like we respect the fact that you raised that $5 million, but we really truly believe that Facebook's going to change these algorithms and it's going to hurt our traffic significantly. And then where will we be at? This deal gives security to 200 employees we have back at that office. Huh. It's a huge win for us. We haven't raised a lot of money. You know, it's a win for our investors and us. And we this is a dream come true for us. Like we did it. So that's when I was like, all right, we started this thing together. We're going to finish it together. And we went and went back into that room and, made the votes, cried. And then the rest was history at that point. We ended up celebrating at night at PhD in New York, you know, in the penthouse, and then threw like a huge party with the team and threw a party at the office. And then we weren't able to talk about it. So for like a couple of weeks, I was like I went through like a depression because it was like, shit, like what you do, the what ifs start kicking in. Like, what if we didn't sell? And what if, and what if, and you know, one of the investors that was coming in for the $5 million was like, you're an idiot. You should have held. You know, this is an opportunity of a lifetime. And you know, it was like, it was stressful to know, but then like a couple buddies growing up and my parents and everybody were like, you know what, like you always want to jump out of a plane without a parachute, but you did it. And, you know, that's when I really got humbled and was able to take care of my family and do certain things I dreamt of and now do what I'm doing now, which, you know, I feel like if that didn't happen, I really don't think I would have really found my purpose in life. And I really started asking myself really tough questions after that sale of like, why did this happen to me? Why did I have this success? You know, looking back at from like the young guy who like was all after money when I was very young and like learning about stocks and then losing it all and then having to deal with like that recession and my parents losing their job, all my friends can't getting jobs, to like pivoting and like figuring out how to leverage what I was passionate about with content. And then like mentoring, I mean, it was tough to mentor David when he was 18 years old, 19 years old into a CEO. And then like, you know, going all the way up into a point where managing 200 employees, I mean, we battled, we had arguments, we bonded. It was a journey, you know, learning how to fire people, hire people, keep the culture, scale the business. It was so much fun, but crazy stressful. And I started asking myself questions like, wow, this was such an unbelievable journey. A lot of people want me to go and talk about this exit. They don't understand the 14 years it took me to get here. And now it's like, I finally felt like a weight was a little off my shoulder. And I started thinking about like my purpose in life, you know, and you know, how I can truly leverage this to make more impact for this millennial generation.
And that's why you founded Founders.
Correct. Yes.
Founders is spelled Founders, right?
It is.
Why?
Well, I just want to teach people to like, you know, to own it, own it, like own who you are, own what you've been through, you know, and just like come take ownership of like what you want out of life, like take ownership of your destiny, take ownership of like a lot of people don't make excuses for your past and what you've been through, like own it, man. That's part of your story. It's part of your journey, you know, own it. And then, you know, it's becoming a founder, you know, you want it to, I want people to take ownership in owning, you know, taking ownership of their life, their business, their career, their craft.
When you started it, it was you trying to kind of give back and teach some of what you've learned, but it was also, was it supposed to be an incubator at the beginning?
Yeah. So it was. I was speaking at Draper's University and like amazed by this ecosystem over there. And then we built Elite Daily at that Black Ocean and seeing that kind of incubator, how that set us up. And then, you know, for me, I felt like so many millennials were following me on social media, sending me questions, sending me emails to mentor them, asking me about like how I did it. And like so many of them were hitting me up at the fact that like they didn't feel college was for them. And I've been there and I'm like, damn, like where do you go if you don't want to go to college and you do want to learn how to start a business or you do want to learn how to learn the skills, how to like be able to build a career? Like where do you go nowadays? And definitely for me in the area that I grew up, you know, there's nowhere to really truly go. I remember for me, it was like my parents' basement. And then it was like a lot of people today, they go to, you know, you work at a Starbucks, a coffee shop, an apartment maybe, but there's really no, like, there was no place for me around New Jersey that you can go and collaborate and rub shoulders with other like passionate, ambitious young people, men and women, and like sharing ideas and working.
Were you thinking of an in-person place to go? It feels like it's gone through. I've seen it a bunch since you started it. It seems like you've been trying to figure out what it is, right? Where to take it since the beginning, frankly, right?
So we finally figured, really figured out the vision. I mean, for me, the number one thing was I wanted to improve. I wanted to be more of like a human accelerator. And for me, what I'm passionate about is, when people come here with these ideas, I want to break them down as to like, why? Why do you have this idea? Why do you think that this is important? You know, like, what do you really truly want out of life? Why are you really truly doing this in a time where it's sexy to be an entrepreneur? Do you even know why you want to do what you're saying you want to do? Or is it just a cool thing to do? And, you know, I wanted to build a place that created serendipity, that created this personal development in these young millennials to figure out what success really meant to them. You know, and to me, to be honest, it was like there was that uncertainty. And the reason being is it's interesting. One of my mentors introduced to me after the exit, this place called Building 20 out of MIT. Have you heard of that?
No. What is it?
So it's this building that, you know, believe it or not, Mark Zuckerberg, if you look up the name of his headquarters, it's Building 20. And Steve Jobs actually designed his first Apple store around Building 20. And I never even knew of it. One of my mentors told me about it. But it's just building, one door in, one door out. It's an open collaborative space. And back in, I don't remember what year it was, but back in the day, all these like creative, innovative students, they didn't know where to put them. They put them in Building 20, and that's where like solar energy was invented and all these great inventions were came out of there. And it was because people were forced to bump into each other. They were forced to collaborate. They were forced to share their ideas. And that's how a lot of these inventions came about. So like I was like, man, I just want to build a Building 20 in Newark. You know, for me, mm-hmm. like one of my biggest inspirations was the fantasy factory that Rob Dyrdek started. I always wanted a fantasy factory, you know? So it's just like, for me, it's like, let's just build this fantasy factory. Let's build this Building 20. Let's build this place that can harness ideas, that can really inspire others, that can help others, you know, really understand how to become the best versions of themselves. And then once we're able to build the founder, then we can start helping them learn how to truly take an idea and build a business around it. And it's been trial and error. We've been testing it out.
So if we want to be a part of it, what's a good who would be a good part of it, and what's a good way for us to become a part of it?
So it's an application process. What's nice is we offer a co-live aspect to it. So we own the buildings that we built Founders in. And, you know, you basically, if you want to be a part of it, you go to founders.com. We open up an application process twice a year. Our next cohort will start in September. So we'll be marketing. When we're marketing through the summer for people to just apply.
If I become a part of it, first of all, I have to apply and be accepted. And then once I'm in, I get a place to work. I get some guidance on my company, kind of like an incubator. I also get a place to live if I want it. Am I right?
Yeah, you're able to get a place to live if you get accepted. And, you know, I bring in world-class speakers. I've had some unbelievable people come here, you know, on a daily basis. We run a workshop, and there's a program. And what's interesting is that this next cohort is really going to have it special. We're baking the model now to be a little bit different as a member. We are building a fitness center. We built a juice cafe. So you're going to have the ability to live, have a place to live for 3 months, have access to the fitness, the juice, you know, the juice cafe. You're going to have a program where it's meditation practices every morning, yoga, like CrossFit and Navy SEAL training. And then we actually have world-class mentors come in every single day and run workshops on teaching you how to get your business model, you know, how to do, you know, marketing, sales, you know, how to raise capital.
Part of this? Is it with equity or cash or both?
It could be one or the other. Up until now, it's been very much equity based. We're going into September. We're looking to now that we actually have the facility with the fitness center, based upon what the feedback we've gotten from the entrepreneurs in these past two cohorts. Now we're going to open it up to be a pay for model where you'll be able to have the apartment and access to all of those amenities.
So if I just want to take this whole co-working space to the next level and actually get more than just a desk somewhere, I can go and pay to be a part of Founders. I get a space. I get access to you, the people who you bring in. We get to be fit. We get to eat right. And we get to build our companies with the same kind of passion and aggression that you had when you were building your business. That's it. Am I right?
Heck yeah. Heck yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. I got to thank Armand Asadi for connecting us. How do you know Armand?
I interviewed him for my YouTube series called Leaders Create Leaders, where I just interview like modern day leaders of our generation. And Armand, I got introduced to through Lewis Howes, who was on Leaders Create Leaders. And, you know, I had worked with Armand a little bit in learning more about his expertise, which is copywriting.
Yeah, he's a great writer.
He's an unbelievable writer. And for me, like I was starting to figure out the strategy. A lot of people were asking me like how I built my personal brand. You know, for like 12, 13 years, all I did was build businesses. And then after selling Elite Daily, I was like, okay, wow, like my brand actually matters. I need to start taking it serious, especially if I'm going to be able to get awareness to bringing people to Newark. And over the past 18 months, I've been able to do, you know, really build it. And it's been a game changer for me. And I had all this strategy, but I was like, okay, how do I actually bake out this strategy so that I can share it with the world? And Armand was the person that I went to work with on baking out, you know, 25 videos on exactly what my strategy was to do that.
I see. I like the guy. I lied. I got to meet him here at Scotch Night at the office and find out a little bit about him. And we've stayed in touch. And I'm glad that he introduced me to you. For anyone who wants to check out your site, actually, there are two sites, right? They can go to your personal site. It's GerardAdams.com. Am I right?
Yep.
Yeah, you've got like a site everywhere. Like there's a visual CV site. There's LinkedIn. You're actually easy to find that way, which I appreciate.
Yeah.
And if they want to check out Founders, it's Founders, F FOWNDERS. Like, put the word own inside of founders.com. And I'm glad that you were here. Of course, the two sponsors that I talked about are AcuityScheduling.com/Mixergy. If you want to make it easier for you to talk to your customers, AcuityScheduling.com/Mixergy. And if you need a new developer, go check out TopTal.com/Mixergy. Thanks, man. Thanks for doing this.
Sweet. Yeah, no, absolutely. I loved it, man. This is good questions. Like, I was super engaged, and thank you for having me.
You bet. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, everyone.